if you try to do something good for another person, are you really doing good for the other person, or are you doing it because it makes you feel good?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that matters. This would be the third thing. I think what matters is you do your best to be the truest version of yourself, whatever that manifestation is. But for me, that probably means I do my best to be benevolent towards other people and not self-centered.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Run Your Life podcast. I'm host Andy Vasily. As always, I want to thank you for your time and energy and for tuning into any episode that you can. On the show today, I have Jim Knight. He's the founder and senior partner of the Instructional Coaching Group and is also a research associate at the University of Kansas Center for Research on Learning and has spent more than two decades studying professional learning and instructional coaching. He earned his PhD in education from the University of Kansas and has won several University Teaching, Innovation, and Service Awards. He's also authored several books, including Unmistakable Impact in 2011, High Impact Instruction 2013, Better Conversations 2015, The Impact Cycle 2018, and the Definitive Guide to Instructional Coaching in 2021. As well, he has written several other books and is, I think, in the process of writing a new book, if I'm not mistaken. What I truly appreciate about Jim is the very thoughtful way that he shares his learning. He's been on my podcast several times, and our conversations are not just about me asking questions and him sharing his knowledge. Jim is very authentic and genuine in the way he shares, and he doesn't ever imply that he has the so-called right answers, but rather remains very curious and centered on what might be rather than what is absolute. And that's what I really appreciate about him. In today's episode, we explore the themes of learning to better know self in order to best show up for those who we coach and lead. We also dive into strategies that help to promote and facilitate peer coaching in organizations, as well the impact of culture on coaching conversations, and lastly, knowing the importance of taking a flexible approach when coaching others. When I reflect on my friendship with Jim and who he really is, this quote comes to mind. A meaningful life is not about being rich, being popular, being highly educated, or being perfect. It's about being real, being humble, and being able to share ourselves and touch the lives of others. To me, this is the essence of who Jim really is. He's so generous with his time and very real. He's a humble person who always strives to learn and grow, and in the process, change the lives of so many leaders and educators that are so lucky to work with him. You can find out where to connect with Jim in the show notes of today's episode. And if you haven't connected with him, I highly recommend doing so and signing up for any of the training that he offers. You won't be disappointed. So with that, now let's jump into my conversation with the inspiring Jim Knight. Jim, we had some difficulties getting connected. I thought it was you. And then in the end, you were like, nope, it's your computer. But that's what sometimes happens recording these podcasts virtually. Just strange things happen. And then we reboot. It seems to be the magic cure. Yeah, it's great to see you. We had a quick little chat before I hit the record button, but you've come on the show a number of times. I always appreciate our discussions, and I'm really thankful for our connection. And I want to also just extend a thank you for your willingness to come back on the show. So thanks a lot.
It's my pleasure. And yeah, it's a weird world, this Zoom world, because you never know when there's a glitch. Is it me? Is it them? And you're always in this kind of never, never land. And yeah. And then eventually somehow it works out.
Yeah, exactly. So people, obviously a lot of people will know your work, but for those listeners who are not familiar with it, can you just let them know who you are, where you're from, and the work that you're most known for?
Sure. So Jim Knight, I live in Lawrence, Kansas, but I grew up in Canada, lived outside of Toronto. And I think you could probably say that I popularized the notion of instructional coaching. I wrote the first book and the first, I think, significant article about instructional coaching. And then we've continued to do that research, done over $30 million worth of research over the decades, looking at what's effective coaching for instructional coaches. And now we have a podcast, Coaching Conversations, that's seen in a lot of countries around the world. And we provide professional development for coaches. There's about 7 or 8 books I've written about coaching. And then we also partner with Growth Coaching International, which is a group out of Australia. Some really great friends of mine, Christian Van Neuerberg, John Campbell, Chris Monroe, all are experts there. And so our scope is broadening. We're becoming more of having a global impact, but also we're learning an enormous amount from our partners in Australia.
Yeah, that's great. And that's the work that I've followed and seen, you know, some of the videos that you're posting. And then you host with Brian Seppi. Like, I don't know how to say his last name. What's his last name?
It's Brian Seppi, but it's now Jessica Wise. Jessica is a person. Jessica just got her doctorate a couple months ago. And I love referring to her as Dr. Wise because it sounds like a Marvel superhero, you know.
Yeah.
Let's go see Dr. Wise and see what the solution is. But Jessica and I have been doing that for a while, and Brian and I are still in contact. He's made the noble decision to go back to working in a school district. So he's working outside of Buffalo, but we still stay in contact, and I'm hoping he's going to write a book. He's got a lot of ideas, so I'm hoping he can put it all together.
Yeah, that's great. What I appreciate about that is the partnership. Like, you obviously having so much experience in the work that you do, still aligning yourself and working alongside people to learn from them. And I think that's what, you know, when I saw you and Brian working on the podcast, I felt that that's what it was about. It was like learning from one another. Even though you have more experience in the field, you sit alongside people and it's obvious the willingness you have to continue to grow and learn. And that's what I appreciate about you and the work that you do. And you know, we've had a few chats on my podcast over the years, and the first one really gave people a dive into early life and how that shaped you and how it propelled you onto the path that you're on now, doing the work that you're meant to do, no doubt. Our last conversation was in November 2022, where we talked about the keys to coaching success. And what I wanted to ask you is, like, since that time, so November 2022, where has your learning taken you, and what is it that you feel most compelled to share now in your work based on that learning and where it's taken you since our last discussion?
Yeah, maybe I'll mention 3 things. I'll have to figure out what the 3 things are as I go, but it's good to have 3.
Yeah.
So I'd say one of the things I'm learning is, I think, how to more clearly articulate when it's appropriate to coach and when it's appropriate not to coach. And so as we work with growth coaching, for example, we work with administrators on how they can become coaches. And it's just the core idea that real change isn't going to happen unless the person you're working with really wants to implement the change.
Yeah.
And so without an emotionally compelling goal, not much is going to happen. And so I think there are sometimes we go into conversations, especially people who are in administrative positions, leadership positions, where something has to be said. A person's a really toxic force on the team. The team can't succeed because of the negative energy the person brings to the room. They're always complaining. They're not constructive. And so the leader has to go in and say, look, I just need to talk to you about the way you're working with that team. That has to stop. That's a situation where you have to be directive. But when you want real change to happen, instead of going into the conversation, trying to persuade the other person to do what you think they need to do, the coaching approach is to try to open up something inside the person that will have, make a big difference for kids if we're working in schools that they really are committed to doing. And so my orientation as a coach is not to get them to agree to what I've decided. My orientation as a coach is to try to get them to set an emotionally compelling goal, something they really care about, that they'll really go after with passion, and not necessarily the thing I would choose. Now, I'm not going to set a goal that isn't good for kids and isn't going to make a big difference. We want a powerful goal. But that orientation, that's the first thing. So the coaching orientation is when I really want to motivate the, or not even motivate, set up the conditions for the person to be motivated. That's the first thing I'd say. The second thing I'd say is that I've got a book coming out in a few months about data. So we've looked at the power of data. It's called Data Rules.
Nice.
And data is integral to growth. I mean, data helps us see things we wouldn't see. So it's integral for equity, for example. Data helps us set goals. Data helps us monitor progress. And whether you're, you know, watching your bank account go smaller or bigger, or you're trying to lose weight or gain weight or run faster or whatever, data is going to be an integral part of it. But often data is like a punishment, not helpful. Mm-hmm. And I remember sitting in meetings in school districts where the director of assessment would say, here's the scores. You guys have to get better. And everybody leaves the room depressed and nobody knows how to get better. And one of the key ideas in our book is the data needs to foster hope, which means it has to be integrated to professional development, which means it's integrated with a pathway to a goal. Not just enough to say, this isn't the score. You have to say, this is where we are and let's explore how we can get there. And for us, that would be coaching. And the third big learning, I've been learning a lot about, these are just off the top of my head, but I've been learning a lot about how to be an ally with other people and how that's really critical, especially right now when people are struggling. And I think it's really important. I'll just speak for myself and not projecting on other people. But for me, it's really important for me to understand my own imperfections, my own suffering, to put it frankly, you know, the struggles I'm dealing with in my life. And, you know, nobody has a perfectly happy life. I'm not sure a perfectly happy life would be that great anyway. But when I can see myself more clearly, see my own frailties, my own pain, it helps me be a much better ally with other people, because then I can sit down with that person and I can say, this too is in me. Instead of showing up judgmental and I need to tell this person what to do and all those things, I can show up as an ally because I'm like you. I feel what you feel. So those are off top of my head. Those are my three things.
So I really appreciate the last one, because I think that's been something that I've been kind of grappling with in a positive way. How to be an ally. And it begins with, how can you be an ally with yourself? Which means being aware of our own inner critic and the inner narrative and how that inner narrative has been constructed. And oftentimes it comes down to past experiences and our relationship with success and failure growing up, and how success and failure was celebrated, right? Or how failure was dealt with harshly. And I think this all has a spillover impact on who we become as adults. And there's a lot of work around trauma, you know, the trauma-informed educator. And I think that's what comes up for me. And what you say is, like, it takes vulnerability to be able to say, this is in me too. These are things that I've struggled with too, instead of being the knowledge authority, right? So I think that is what I'm most, when I said I wanted to share what I've been grappling with, that's it. It's like, how can you learn to navigate that space within self in order to be the best version of yourself for others? So can you speak more in depth? Selfishly, I'd love for you to expand on that third point and how that's helped you just to be a better person.
There's so much wrapped up. Such a great question. First off, I want to really agree with you. Kristen Neff, who's sort of the world's leading expert on self-compassion, she says you should treat yourself like somebody you like. And my friend Anne Hoffman says, you imagine two people walking down the road and it's icy out, probably not icy in Saudi Arabia, but let's just say we're in Canada, and it's icy on the street, and your friend falls and they slip on the ice. Your first reaction is, oh, are you okay? Can I help you? Did you get hurt? No wonder you fell. Somebody should take care of this road. It's ridiculous. It's just slippery. Your whole orientation is towards compassion. Mm-hmm. If you fall down, I can't even walk down the road without falling down. What an idiot I am. Like, your first orientation is to be critical. And I think just that basic concept of treating yourself as someone you like is a really, really important first step. One thing I would say is, I've got a couple things to share about that. We'll do three again.
Okay.
One of them is, we'll do self-compassion as the first one. The second thing is, I think we are way more complex than just one thing. What I mean by that is, you'll hear people say, you know, I'm not really a very good listener, or, you know, I'm not really great at controlling my emotions, or I'm pretty disorganized, or you might say I'm really organized, or however you'd put it. But we try to describe ourselves as if it were one thing. Mm-hmm. And I think that really, and then other people do it too. Other people will say to us, well, I don't want you in charge because you're not very organized. They'll project a label on us that kind of puts us in a box. And I think human beings are way more complex than just one thing. Sometimes they're good listeners. Sometimes they're not. Sometimes they're organized. Maybe they're organized for a whole project. Other times they're not so organized. And people are in flux. They're changing. But they're not just one thing. Probably the world's best listener has had, I don't know who that would be, but the world's best listener has probably had times when they weren't listening very well. And the world's worst listener, maybe by chance or whatever, but has had times when they're going to. And so the point of that would be that it doesn't matter what happened in the past, and it doesn't matter what happens in the future. When it comes to communication, at least, what matters is this conversation right now. Mm-hmm. Maybe I've been really distracted in my conversations the last couple of weeks because I'm worried about the University of Kansas lost their star player. They're not going to do well in the tournament. And so it's got me distracted. But in this conversation, even though I haven't done so great the last couple of weeks, in this conversation, I can do well. So I think that we shouldn't limit ourselves. We should recognize that all that matters is this conversation. So things like how we listen, how we ask questions, how we demonstrate empathy or compassion, how we engage our will for the good of the other person. Maybe we were really self-centered yesterday. Maybe we lost our cool for trivial reasons and now we regret it. That doesn't matter. What matters is this conversation. Mm-hmm. And other people's opinion of us, that doesn't matter either. What matters is how we deal with it. So that would be the second point. We are way more complex. And because of our complexity, we always have the potential to do better. We're not limited by a label of being one kind of person. It's kind of like fixed mindset versus growth mindset. Mm-hmm. The third thing's a little smaller, but I also think, you know, in high school philosophy classes, we used to get into these arguments. If you try to do something good for another person, are you really doing good for the other person, or are you doing it because it makes you feel good? Mm-hmm. And I don't think that matters. This would be the third thing. I think what matters is you do your best to be the truest version of yourself, whatever that manifestation is. But for me, that probably means I do my best to be benevolent towards other people and not self-centered. You know, self-centeredness erodes trust. Mm. But at the same time, it's complicated. It's not just one thing. If I'm doing what makes me feel good, but it's helping another person, then I'm going to help the other person. I'm not going to get hung up on those kind of things. I think sometimes we get concerned that, is this a benevolent act? Is this selfish? Just do what seems authentic. And probably that's benevolence. I think our motives are always a little complicated, a little more messy than just either we're loving towards the person or we're self-centered. That's always a little complicated. So just do the best thing, you know, do the right thing and see what happens is the way I would put it.
Yeah, I love that. And a lot comes up for me when you're saying that. And the first thing is Dr. Richard Schwartz and Internal Family Systems, where he talks about parts work, you know, and being aware, because what you said kind of succinctly hits upon that, which is we don't have just one identity. We have multiple parts that show up within us. So I think going back to Goleman's work around self-awareness is this idea of like just being aware of our internal state and what's happening and what part might be showing up. And, you know, Richard Schwartz talks about this idea of the firefighter, you know, wanting to put the fire out right away, or the protector or the pleaser. So it's that idea of just being aware of the part that is showing up, and not to distract you from being present, but just to say, okay, that part's showing up right now. I really don't need that part right now, but just to be aware of it, not to push it away, and to sit alongside of it. And the other thing, when you were talking about, like, we can be harsh with ourselves, the falling on the ice example, you know, saying, oh, I'm such a fool, you know, whatever, I'm clumsy, I'm an idiot. But Dr. Jim Lehrer, Leading with Character, talks about this idea that we would never want what we say to ourselves broadcasted on the Jumbotron of the Final Four for 80,000 people to say, because it's really harsh, right? Mm-hmm. It can be really harsh. So I really connect with what you're saying there. And that idea of being present, I have Sharon Salzberg coming on the podcast in April, and I'm really looking forward to talking to her, because it's the power of presence, and it is a skill that you can build to develop that self-awareness. But this goes back to your first point about your learning, which is when to coach and when not to, and being able to read that situation and being able to move out of one role to best support the person in another role, right? So can you just double click on that idea of when to coach and when not to coach, and the power of presence and self-awareness in recognizing when it's time to switch gears and go moving from a coaching conversation to what? Is it simply just listening what's on top for them? Is it, you know, what can that look like? Like, what's your advice there when switching gears?
Yeah, I don't know if it's a different role, but I know that's the way people talk about it. I've talked about, we're going to put the coaching hat on now, and now I'm going to put on the, I think, you know, if you're a quarterback, I'll use your sports analogies here, Andy. If you're a quarterback and you're playing the game, and you notice the defense is different than you expect. It looks like they're going to, you know, they're going to send six guys across the line to try to tackle me, or you know, whatever. Then you call an audible and you change what happens, and you have a different play, and you have a repertoire of plays. And then you look at the situation and you say, what's most important in this situation? What do I need to, given what I'm looking at, what's the most important thing? So I feel like the coaching approach is just one way of leading, and it's poorly understood and poorly implemented often, even by me. You know, I should know how to do it since I've written about 10 books about it. I should be able to figure it out by now. But it is almost counterintuitive what you do. So I would say it's not so much about I'm moving from a different role, but I have different, much like a quarterback, I have different plays and different circumstances. This seems to be a circumstance where the coaching approach makes more sense than the directive approach. And then even within the coaching approach, there's, we would say, a dialogical approach and a facilitative approach. A facilitative approach is where the person already knows the answers. And I just have to help them set a goal. I have to help them make a plan. They already know what they need to know. The dialogical approach is where the person actually doesn't have the knowledge, and I am actually an expert at that knowledge. I have expertise, but I still don't tell them what to do. I want them to set a goal that matters, so I share ideas as options, like a menu. And I say something like, do you mind if I share a few ideas and you tell me which one of these gives you the most energy? And so I'm still striving for an emotionally compelling goal the person wants to hit when I'm in the dialogical approach. The directive approach is, there's a message that has to get through. Sometimes what happens when you give a person a directive message is they look you in the eye and they say, thank you so much for telling me that. I didn't know that. They're really grateful for the fact of that, you know, as Brené Brown famously says, clear is kind. So I think, you know, you've got these plays, but the last thing I would say about this, I'm hoping this is working into a three, but anyway, the last thing I'd say about this is it comes down to what's the purpose of this conversation? What's my intention going into the conversation? It's kind of like when you look at curriculum, is it acquisition or is it transfer? So sometimes when I sit down with a teacher, I have a message. It's like three sentences. I have to make sure they hear the message. And it's critical. Hopefully that's the rarest kind of conversation I have with teachers. But sometimes that has to happen. Other times, what I'm really trying to do is get this person, work with this person so they're excited about a change process. And I want to help them organize that change process. Sometimes I'm helping them understand the strategies they're going to use and set the goals. Other times I'm just helping them go with what they're already doing. Mm-hmm. So I'm helping them figure it out. The other thing is too, in terms of deciding, should it be directive or should it be a more coaching approach? And I would say that comes down to sometimes the simplicity of the problem. You know, if somebody comes to me and says, Jim, you live in Lawrence, Kansas. How do I get to Allen Fieldhouse? They don't want me to say, you know, other times you've tried to find landmarks and cities, what's worked for you? They want me to tell them how to get there. It's simple.
Yeah.
But if I tried to do a simple direction for how to deal with your multilingual kids and your neurodiverse kids and the kids who just came to class 3 weeks ago and they're just learning English and the kids with disabilities and then the kids who are already making plans for the Ivy League school they're going to go to, there's no simple lesson. And having the teacher set a goal, an emotionally compelling goal, is probably way more likely going to, because then it becomes adaptive, you know. Ron Heifetz talks about the difference between technical problems and adaptive problems. A technical solution, you can just tell the person, here's what I think you should do. But if it's an adaptive challenge, then you need something more like a coaching process. That's how I would see it.
And when you talk about intention, so you talked about this idea of the coach having an intention going in.
Well, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I was really talking about it from the perspective of an administrator. If I'm a coach, if I'm an instructional coach or whatever kind of educational coach, then I'm probably almost always going to be working from the facilitative and dialogical. I'm always going to be coaching. I would only be directive when I feel there's something, something that has to be said. Now there may be things that are kind of, but it would be this, I would speak up because I see coaching between peers.
Yeah.
As being no different than being a team member. There may be times when I'm on a team where I have to be directive and say to one of my colleagues, you know, what I just heard you say, it made me think this. You know, I might need to be directive about the fact they're saying something that's a microaggression or their expectations are too low, but it wouldn't be any different than a person on a team being directive with a colleague. That's how I see coaching. But if I'm an administrator, it's a much bigger playing field. There's way more things I have to deal with. Plus, I have less time. So it makes it more challenging.
Yeah. What is your advice to people schools that don't have instructional coaches who've tried to implement peer coaching? What is your advice to teachers that are trying to create the conditions for peer coaching? Like what are one or two or three things that can be done for teachers to be able to begin the process of peer coaching?
Well, we have a course on that. Like we have a 2-day course where we go to a school, we help the school implement peer coaching. So especially international schools where they're not really going to likely hire. Although I think it's inevitable that international schools will start to hire instructional coaches because the impact is so powerful. But regardless, let's say they're in that situation. I think the first thing is you have to determine what kind of approach to coaching you want to do, what kind of peer coaching approach. But if you're going to take an instructional coaching approach, then the essence of instructional coaching is you set a powerful student-focused goal you want to change, something you want to see that's different, and then you identify a strategy to help you get there. So that goal could be related to engagement. That goal could be related to achievement or well-being. But it's a powerful, tangible. We don't really like SMART because there's some elements of it that don't particularly work. Like I don't think the timely part works particularly well, and it's really ignoring the fact that it has to be an emotionally compelling. It depends on what the word SMART means. It could mean different things. You could make it work, but it has to be a goal the person cares about. And so if you take the instructional coaching approach to make that happen, your teachers do need to learn how to have a coaching process to follow, a structure to follow. Now, the structure is adaptive. It changes all the time, but you need some structure to follow. We use the concept of freedom within form. You need the form to work it through. Then there's a set of beliefs a way of being that guides coaching, and there are coaching skills, particularly the way you ask questions and the way you listen. So those three things would be integral. And then if you're taking in whatever kind of coaching it is, what are my beliefs? What are my principles that guide my way of being? What are the way I communicate? Person who talks 90% of the time probably isn't coaching. Mm. Probably want it the other way around. At least 80% the other person's talking. And then what's my conversational framework? We use a thing called the impact cycle. So teachers could do that with each other. But the second thing is, I think you'd want to have in the district an instructional framework that people understand. Mm. So it could be Brian Goodwin's The New Classroom Instruction That Works. It's a new version of what Marzano created. He and I are working on a book now about instructional coaching for that. It could be Hattie's work. It could be some combination. So it could be what Rick Stiggins says about formative assessment and what Randy Sprick says about community building in the classroom. It could be the one that's been created in Melbourne and in Victoria. I think it's called High Impact Teaching Strategies. It's a free pro, but everybody needs to know those strategies so that when let's say you and I were paired up and you watch a video of my class and I watch a video of your class and you coach me and I coach you, then we have an instructional framework where we say, oh, we've learned about intention here, you know, clear intentions or formative assessment or behavioral expectations or increasing positive attention on behavior or small group activities or whatever it might be. We've got these things we've learned. I wonder which one of these things would help you hit your goal. Mm. So I coach you through setting the goal, and I coach you through, because the trouble is, without a conversational framework and some expertise about coaching, it just becomes a nice conversation.
Yeah, exactly.
Not much happened. And if you don't have a collective knowledge about the teaching practices, you don't have a pathway to the goal. And the thing is, without the coaching, without the peer coaching, you do all these workshops on, like I said, the new classroom instruction that works or whatever it is, but they don't actually translate into practice. So you spend years talking about the high impact teaching strategies, but it's always just kind of superficial. But if you ground it in some kind of coaching where people are really, what does that look like? How do we do it? Does it help us set the goal? And you set that up, then I think you've got a lot of potential for real powerful things happening.
I remember you once saying, I think I have this right, is that the coaching cycle takes 4 hours roughly?
Oh, I would say it's unclear.
Okay.
because my goal might be to use a new graphic organizer to ensure my kids understand concepts, and I pick it up really quickly and I hit the goal pretty quickly. Or my goal might be, you know, I really don't understand how to create a safe learning environment in my classroom. Mm. And also I don't really know the content.
Right.
And so, you know, but we would say if you wanted to pick an average, it's 6 to 8 weeks to go through.
So that would be the same whether there's an instructional coach or peer coaching process, do you think?
I think with the peer coaching process, you have to look at what's possible, what's real.
Based on time.
It's probably going to be less than that, you know, yeah. But I would say it's probably, you know, if you're really going to work it through, it's probably going to be something like that. And then you just have to find ways to communicate, and you have to think about all the other competing things in the school and say, are there things we can take off people's plates so they can do this? Because this is probably going to be more effective.
Right. The last thing I want to get into before we finish up our conversation is have you read this book, Aaron Meyer's Cultural Map?
I've got it on my shelf and I haven't read it yet, but it's...
Just, it's so fascinating. And it makes me think of, you know, the different schools I work with and through my consulting and coaching in like Asia as opposed to Europe, and then the types of teachers you're working with. And what she talks about is this cultural map where she describes the 8 scales. And the scales are communicating, evaluating, leading, deciding, trusting, disagreeing, scheduling, persuading. Mm. So what she does is she has these, 1, 2, 3, 4. Yeah. It's like a continuum. So depending on a context, for example, some cultures like low context, they just need low context, whereas some like high context, some like direct negative feedback, as opposed to in Japan, for example, they like indirect negative feedback. In terms of decision-making, the Japanese like consensual decision-making, whereas other cultures like top-down, You know, so you've worked with enough schools and enough teachers to know, you know, some of the schools we have in common, you've worked at. And so I know that you understand the impact of culture on coaching conversations. That's what I'm most grappling with too, is how does it need to be flexible to meet the needs of the culture and kind of find, like you'll see with Aaron Meyer's work, the cultural map, and you can see like cultures are all over the place in terms of what their needs are. So what have you grappled with the most in terms of bringing your coaching to different cultures, and what have you learned through that?
Well, first off, I think you're absolutely right. I think it's we make a big mistake to assume what works in Chicago is going to work in New Delhi. You know, it's quite a bit different. And I'm always hesitant to make generalizations, but I would say you really have to be, you know, aware, conscious. That book is probably extremely helpful for this. Mm. I worked with a group out of Harvard that did a study on coaching for midwives in India. And I had shared with them the partnership principles and better conversations beliefs and how we interact. And it just became pretty clear that in the caste system of India, for a person lower in status in the system to speak frankly to a person higher in status was not going to happen. Mm-hmm. And so they had to look at the way power is used and rethink the way we approach it. Because my assumption was everybody wants, you know, DC and Ryan's work on autonomy, that applies everywhere. Everybody, and maybe it still does apply, but the culture is so locked into status and who says what to whom that it was really hard for a midwife to tell a doctor something. So I agree. I think you have to be sensitive. I think even within the United States, what happens in Minnesota is going to be different than what happens in Los Angeles. And that's going to be different than what happens in New Orleans or New York. You know, the different parts of the country have different, and you have to be careful about that. So some parts of the country, I would say, really emphasize community and family more than productivity. Mm-hmm. And it's almost racist to just assume, well, my focus on let's get the job done and get it right, you know, productivity is superior. It's a different culture and they see things differently, and you have to recognize what works here and what works here is going to be different. So I think you should read that book, Culture Maps, and you should be really, it's the same thing with between like personality too. Like some people are introverts, some people are extroverts. So when we first started coaching, several of our instructional coaches had literally been cheerleaders in high school. And so their approach was the cheerleader approach. I'm going to go in here and gung ho. That didn't work for everybody. Some people are like, just give me the article. I'll read it and we'll talk in 2 weeks, you know, and you have to read what's the best way to respond to this person and then do your best to do that.
Yeah. I appreciate what you're saying. The book gives a great example of a French woman who was really good at what she did. And then she was so excited because she got the transfer to Chicago. And then she goes to Chicago to work with the team. And it was the first time she was going to work abroad. And then all of a sudden, Aaron Meyer was coaching her. Okay. Mm. So the French woman's story to Aaron was like, oh, I'm thriving here. It's amazing. I'm doing amazing work. But Aaron was also talking to the executive that hired her to go to Chicago to do the work. And the executive was like, she just doesn't get it. She doesn't get feedback. She doesn't get, like, I have told her so many times what she needs to improve on. But at the end, what Aaron's work showed is that the Americans like the two stars and a wish, whereas the French want it direct, straight on. So where this French woman was failing to see the feedback was that it was clouded by all the positivity before delivering the negative feedback. So then she couldn't absorb the real brunt of the negative feedback and what she had to do because it was clouded by positivity. And that's a perfect example of knowing each other's cultures and the way that feedback is both given and received, And then understanding that and calling that out and putting it on the table and recognizing it. So I just wanted to share that.
Yeah, that's great.
So it does have me thinking about if I'm working with a world language team, like a Japanese, the language teachers, it's going to be different. And I have to learn to navigate that space and let go of a lot of things that I feel are best in coaching, that best works. So yeah, I just wanted to share that. But in closing, Jim, can you let people know anything you want about any workshops coming up or anything you want them to know about initiatives that you and your team are working on and where they can find you?
Yeah, thank you. I just have a little story about the culture thing.
Sure, which I'd love it. Yeah.
I was in Japan. I was invited there to talk about inclusive instruction, which was research at the University of Kansas, where I was a doc student, you know, a thing called content enhancement. And I had a wonderful host. He took me everywhere, went up Mount Fuji. We did all these great things, took me out for sushi. And then he spent days with me and he wanted me to have it. He said he really wanted me to have a great, great experience when I was in Japan. And then he said to me, I was flying home like at 8 o'clock on Monday. And on Sunday, he said, you probably want to go enjoy, you know, Tokyo, go out and see some of the sights and things. You probably don't want to be with me on Monday. And I was like, no, I'd love to have lunch with you. But really what he was saying is, I've got a lot of work to do.
Yeah.
And then when we got together for lunch, I realized he didn't actually want to meet me for lunch. And I, to be honest, would have rather gone around and seen the city because I'd spent so much time with him, you know. So I was unskilled at understanding what he was saying. I didn't pick up what he was saying. And all the more important to better understand how people communicate, pause before you respond, I'd say would be a key part of it. So,
Jim, can I just share one thing? Cause we lived in Japan for 10 years.
Oh yeah.
And it took me 10 bloody years to figure out there's an expression in Japanese, which is shogunai, which means it can't be helped. So, and it's beautiful in itself because it's like, hey, you know, external locus of control, internal locus of control. I cannot control that. And I was quarterback of the Hiroshima football team and we were playing in the national championship and we went up and we played at the Tokyo Dome. I was the one of two foreigners on the team and it was flag football. It wasn't real football, but we had every penalty called against us the entire game. We were leading. We end up losing the game. I was so pissed off. I was so angry at the end of the game. And it was obvious that the referees were calling penalties against us because we were the only foreigners playing in the game. Mm-hmm. And one of the referees had played on the team we were playing against the year before. So I was furious and I was like half Japanese, like trying to confront the referees and my team's pulling me back. And I'm like the foreign barbarian, like the gaijin who loses control. And my team was like, Andy-san, shogunai. And I'm like, F shogunai, this can be helped. This can be helped. But at the end, it was literally like, shogunai. There's nothing we can do. It's done, you know? Yeah. And it's a beautiful way of saying, like, I didn't understand it. And then it took me so long to understand the beautiful expression shogunai and what it meant is letting go of things you can't control. But so where can people find you and any workshops coming up?
Yeah, we have a lot of things people can do. So if they're interested in instructional coaching, we have a virtual institute every 16 weeks. And it's ridiculous, 16 weeks, 3 hours a week. But we said, if you're really going to succeed as an instructional coach, there are things you need to know. Everybody gets 6 books. We go through all the books one by one. Jessica Wise and I, Dr. Wise, and I go through the material and real sense of community develops. It's quite wonderful. We also have a lot of stuff for administrators, more and more, based on our partnership with Growth Coaching. So we're just finishing. It's called an Introduction to Leadership Coaching. Happens for 6 weeks for 2 hours a week, and a real sense of community grows, and people practice every day. It's funny, you know, we spend half our Zoom time practicing the skills, and so far nobody has said to us, you know, we really want more lecture. People really appreciate the chance to try the ideas out and do it. And then we work directly with people around the world. We're doing an institute in April in Paris. So we're going to do another one in Singapore in the fall or early winter. And so if you just go to our websites, instructionalcoaching.com, probably if you type in instructionalcoaching.anything, it'll take you there. Dot Co or whatever it might be. And there's tons of stuff. There's also hundreds of free resources you can download, literally hundreds. And then the podcast is called Coaching Conversations. It's Coaching Conversations with Jim Knight. So it's on whatever podcast thing you use, so long as it's Spotify or iTunes.
Okay.
That's,
yeah.
That's where it is.
And Twitter, Jim Knight, Wayne Gretzky, 99, right?
Yeah, Jim Knight, 99. And then people can email me, jim@instructionalcoaching.com. That would work too.
Okay, great. Thanks for that. And I'm not sure if you know, but we're moving to Belgium.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, we're leaving Saudi and we're moving to Belgium and we're really excited about it. We'll be working at an international school there. So I hope to see you in Europe face to face one day. But I really appreciate your time, Jim. And it's always so insightful. And just the conversations always inspire me. So thank you.
I love our conversation. I'm grateful for them.
So everybody, thank you very much for listening to this episode with Jim Knight. And I hope you come back to listen to future episodes. Of that much I know, I'm sure. Keep on laughing at the rain, I guess. Isn't that the place to start? Someday you will be stronger than you are now, but you will not know everything. And when the water's spilling over the bow, you'll still have me in the wings. You gotta get up to get down, kid. You gotta get down to get up again. You gotta get up to get down, kid. You gotta get down to get up again. Your mother like she's made of gold. After all, she brought you here. And if you're lost, go see the ocean. It will always help you steer. Someday you will be stronger than you are now, but you will not know everything. The water spilling over the bow, you'll still have me in the wings. You gotta get up to get down, kid. You gotta get down to get up again. You gotta get up to get down, kid. You gotta get down to get up again. Than I am now, and I still won't know everything. But when I'm passing up and over the clouds, I hope that you'll have learned from me. Someday you will be stronger than you are now, but you will not know everything. When the water's spilling over the bow, you'll still have me in the wings. You gotta get up to get down, kid. You gotta get down to get up again. You gotta get up to get down, kid. You gotta get down to get up again. Gotta get up to get down, kid. You gotta get down to get up again. You gotta get up to get down, kid. Hey. You gotta get down to get up again.